Americans love a good story, even if it isn't true. Kevin Young is the author of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. In it, he traces the history of hoaxes in the United States, from P.T. Barnum's freak shows to current-day fake journalism, and their particular fascination with race. Kevin Young is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and poetry editor at The New Yorker. He's the author of 12 books of poetry and prose. I asked Kevin Young what compelled him to step away from poetry to take on con artists.
They sort of took me on, I guess. I was always, like a lot of us, I mean, they're fascinating just to think about. And the con artist is an American invention. So I started thinking a lot about, you know, what that meant. What did it tell us about our history? And a lot of my poetry is interested in history in a big sense, whether it's slavery or thinking about sort of our current moment and my parents growing up in the South. So it kind of all was something I was thinking about. But then really when I started digging in to the history of the hoax, I started realizing that, A, we told the history kind of backwards or at least as if the hoax was just sort of a lark when it really has this long history. And also I started thinking about whether or not it was something deeply American.
Is it something deeply American?
I'd say so. I came to understand the ways in which it was. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way we think about ourselves and the way we think about self-invention, self-reliance. All those things I think are things that hoaxers prey upon. But also kind of inspire us sometimes, maybe in wrong ways, to think about. You know, I had to kind of take out all the movies that are about con artists because there's so many. And I really started focusing on this tradition that I saw start with P.T. Barnum in the 1830s and going up to the present day. And what struck me was how much what happened in Barnum's time reflected on our own.
Yeah, let's start with P.T. Barnum, who's considered a great showman and was known for creating shows that everyone wanted to come and see. And you start with Joyce Heth. Tell us a little bit about Joyce and her role in P.T. Barnum's shows.
Well, Heth was a figure who Barnum displayed in 1835. She was African-American. She had been a slave, we know. We think he might have enslaved her as well. We know that what he did is he showed her and said that she was George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old, which he trumpeted widely as being true. She was very popular. She became his first big success and really started him on this road of hoaxing.
And throughout, you find a tie between hoaxes and racial stereotyping or sort of exoticism of the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is interesting about Heth is the way that people came to see her in order to connect to this great history, connect to American history and the father of our nation. And I think she was very popular. And in a way, her popularity probably led to her hastened at least her death. She was, of course, of just advanced normal age. But the travel across the Northeast probably killed her. She died of exposure, we think. And then sort of as a strange coda, Barnum then took her body and had her autopsied in a public theater, which he charged admission to.
Using her even in her death to sell tickets.
And, you know, this sort of process, she wasn't alone in how people who were seen as different were treated even after death. But I start to see the ways that, you know, Barnum was examining something else about the American psyche. And a lot of the hoax, I started to realize, is dependent on race. And what's more, I came to realize that race itself as an idea can start to seem like a hoax, which is to say a fake thing pretending to be real.
Why do hoaxes and racial stereotypes seem so often to go hand in hand? Why does one depend on the other?
Well, I mean, stereotypes aren't true, and they require a certain kind of belief that precedes any kind of actual evidence. So there's that. But I also think that I would even go further to say that race itself, which is an idea in its modern sense that grew up the same time as the hoax did, both date to the middle of the 18th century, the word hoax. Of course, people have been lying for a long time, but hoaxing in the middle of the 18th century as a word, the hoax, came to be. And that's a right around when race and our notion of hierarchies as a thing tied to skin color came about. And I don't think that's an accident. And as the hoax grew in the U.S., you start to see the ways it was often tied, even in later Barnum exhibitions, to race. He, for instance, in 1860, right at the start of the Civil War, showed a figure he called "What Is It?" question mark. And he meant it to be the missing link in evolution. This is right after Darwin's revolutionary ideas in Origin of Species. And I think it's really troubling and cautionary that he was able to sort of suggest that this black man, who we know was named William Johnson, was the missing link in essence. What is it? He was asking audiences to judge for themselves whether Darwin sort of was right or wrong, or how we could think about it in a really practical way. And he was really smart about making money off that.
Yeah, P.T. Barnum was, he seemed to be very self-aware. He argued that what he was doing was actually an art form and that the viewers were in many ways complicit. Do you think the viewers were there because they wanted to believe? Or you said that the viewers are being allowed to judge for themselves, but it is also playing into their desire to feel superior?
Absolutely. It's this interesting mix that I think Barnum tapped into, and I think others have more recently, in this notion of wanting to be the evaluator. I think what Barnum provided is the idea that anyone could be an expert, and you too could sit in judgment and decide. And it's a very American democratic ideal, and I think that's what's really interesting about it. And often, the judges, of course, found themselves superior to the beings being shown by Barnum, which he called a variety of things, from curiosities to often they people were called freaks, of course, but they were just, say, natives from a different place, or pretend natives even more often. And so Barnum really capitalized on it. But I also think it was that was true for the audience. The audience really, I think, engaged in the best analogy I can come up with is reality TV, because it's a bit like we know it's fake sometimes, but we get invested somehow in how things go, who the relationships and the sort of procession, as it were, of people. And I think that very much that's a Barnum-esque feeling.
You know, P.T. Barnum was creating, he was staging things. He was creating a sort of theater. But there are other people that you document in your book who actually transformed themselves. They pretended to be Native American or black. And this is something we see all throughout history and right into recent chapters of people taking on an identity that is not their own. How do they differ from what P.T. Barnum was doing? I mean, in one, he's obviously creating a scene, but in them, it's involving self-transformation. Is there a different motivation at play?
Well, I hesitate to guess people's motivation sometimes, because often they're what they say they're motivated by is not exactly. Sometimes it's money more often than not. Certainly, there's a level of attention seeking that is going on to both of them. They're, instead of displaying someone else, they're displaying themselves, because it's not like they're pretending to be this thing and they're shrinking violets. So they generally speaking, go on a lecture tour as a native expert, as the Hoaxer Gray Owl did.
Or they head up a local chapter of the NAACP.
Right. They can't just, hang out. And so there's a way in which I'm trying to understand that display part as well. But also, I think it's important to say, why do we believe? And, I'm not convinced fully that some of the people closest to these figures didn't understand that they were pretending. But why do we, as in general, go along or play along, or more to the point, believe in these figures who often are not just doing sort of harmless play dress up, which I don't think is ever really quite harmless. But I also think they're saying something about the people they're pretending to be. As Native American pretenders, or sometimes people call them pretendians, are often pretending to be super tragic. They're all of these figures are constructed as these kind of about to be extinct, tragic non-people, and it really becomes takes up the space of the actual people who have these experiences, which are nuanced and quite different.
And how disturbing is it that this is something that happens so frequently that there's a term for it, pretendian?
It's disturbing. I mean, after I finished sort of this, you know, book, which is by no means, you know, a brief chronicle, I started to realize there were a lot of liars and a lot of hoaxes. You know, many more popped up. And I think that some of your listeners will probably be aware of some of these that happen sort of in our backyards. And I think that it's really a troubling trend, but also a sort of deeply historic one. It's one that didn't just start happening. So perhaps we should be less surprised that it hasn't gone away.
A disturbing number, at least for me, a disturbing number of the con artists you write about are journalists, people who write supposedly real stories, and then suddenly out of the blue, they're writing a big story that turns out to be a total sham. This is far from reassuring. How do you explain somebody who seems to be going about doing their job from day to day, but suddenly out of the blue, they're like, nope, I'm going to drop this big story on people.
That's interesting. I mean, I think for me, there are always these warning signs with the people I chronicle. Someone like Stephen Glass, you know, had many, many forays into the fakery. And I trace one that's, you know, perhaps even of him as an undergrad in a student newspaper. So it's not like overnight this became true. I think there's a few things to say. One is that I always try to stress that journalists catch these journalists. It isn't just that, you know, they get busted in some random way. It's purposeful, good journalism that I think confronts this fakery. And it's usually a couple bad apples who exploit aspects of the system that I think is indeed troubling and maybe tells us a little bit about the system. But then I think there are ways that journalistic skepticism, which I think is a fruitful, useful thing, can investigate. Now, I do think they tell us something about objectivity, which I think is perhaps not the best goal in journalism and is a fairly recent phenomenon, as you probably know. But I do think there's ways to talk about what a journalist does that can combat fakery. And some of it is reliable sources, many different sources, and also, you know, not being tricked by sort of what people are telling about other people, because, you know, which perhaps is journalism's goal, but I mean also in the sense of a diverse newsroom would have stopped a lot of these hoaxes, which were about race and which were about a kind of fakery that then couldn't be questioned because people didn't know how to talk about it.
So it seems that at the root of this problem is a lack of familiarity, you know, not knowing the other, and therefore you're easily seduced by a story that seems in some ways too good to be true, but is just so blatantly different from your own experience.
Well, it's a good way to put it. I mean, I also think it's about power in some ways and about the power to, you know, say, put on blackface, which I think is traditionally been an American phenomenon, but also a white phenomenon. So we have to think about the ways that, you know, Barnum in 1835 was showing Joyce Heth, but it's not an accident. That's also when blackface was invented, almost to the year. And I talk about that a little bit, how that kind of grows up around the same thing. And there is this American love of display and taking on that I think is often a sign of privilege. I also think that there's a negotiation people are having with their own fears. And that really interests me because I started out thinking about, you know, why do people deceive? Why do these few people do these things to the rest of us? But then I started thinking about why we believe and the ways that we're invested and what makes, I think, some of the stories that I tell more troubling is because they are not promoting the best of us. You know, the journalists you mentioned are telling tragic stories that we latch onto and somehow need to believe for the time being. And I think that's what's troubling, is that change in the hoax from even Joyce Heth, who was somewhat obviously troubling being autopsied, but was meant to be honorific, meant to honor this great American past. And now the stories are all tragic. They're all stories of one horror after another, a bit like Pizzagate. You know, it's not like that story would have been believed if it's like, hey, there's a place in D.C. that has great pizza. It's instead this horrible story about our worst fears about someone else. And I think that that kind of combination is one that I'm interested in examining and thinking about closely and together.
You know, when you mentioned Pizzagate, and that's the instance of accusations of pedophilia happening in the basement of a pizza joint that was supported by Hillary Clinton.
And it doesn't have a basement.
And it doesn't have a basement. But the consequences, I mean, you talked about sort of power. It seems like the stakes for these hoaxes are getting higher and higher. What we talk about, fake news stories that are popping up in our social media feeds, elections. Is the hoax rising in power right now?
I do think we're in an extremely bad patch. I think not only are there more hoaxes, the hoaxes themselves are far worse. And I think that partially is due to technology. I think that it can be harder to reverse the effects of a hoax, disprove things that seem true. And we have a news cycle that can't almost keep up with the debunking. And that, I think, is really troubling. But then there's also this, I think, cynicism that's happened more culturally, more broadly speaking, where people just assume all news is fake, or they dismiss things they don't like as fake news. And what that does is only increase that. You'd think it would protect you, but I think it only increases people launching things that, you know, aren't true at all. But then even this weirder kind of like kind of there's like a one little percent of truth that is being exploited. And I really worry that there is a kind of half hoax world that we've come to where we don't ever get to this actual thing called the truth.
Did we set ourselves up in terms of creating a culture that wants to believe in the best of ourselves at the expense of knowing the truth of ourselves?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, I would almost say so, but I do see in this tracing of the hoax the ways that our fears were often stoked by fakery. And it's not just like really great fakery that later anyone would be fooled by. It's that later when you look at it, many of these hoaxes, just we have a hard time believing anyone ever believed them. They seem so obvious after the fact. So it makes us have to think about, well, why did we go that, you know, why did we ignore all the warning signs? Why did we sort of push past that and say, well, let's just roll the dice anyway? Because I think there's a wish behind the hoax that the hoax expresses. I think that unstated wish is the thing we have to examine.
And I wonder about the more subtle versions of a hoax or a con. I mean, we started out by talking about P.T. Barnum. There's a new movie out called The Greatest Showman, starring Hugh Jackman. And they're billing it him as this great man who brought together and defended the people on the fringe. That here he was. This was a place for the odd people to come together and build a community in his show. When the truth is, he was putting people like Joyce Heth on display and, you know, having their bodies autopsied and selling tickets for it.
Right. Well, I think the complicated part about Barnum is, and I think even show people and circus folk, is they did create community. You know, they did in the course of things find identities and live lives and love and do all the things that people do, I think. But it doesn't mean that was because of Barnum, you know. I think it was because of them. And I really started finding their heroism really interesting. The man I was telling about, William Johnson, who was called What Is It? He was seen by approximately 100 million people in the course of his lifetime. I mean, just a huge amount of people saw him because he was constantly on the road. He did it for 60 years. And then on his deathbed, he supposedly said to his sister, well, we sure fooled them a long time, didn't we? And, you know, so I want to – he's on the cover of my book because I want to think about what he had to tell that doesn't get told by Barnum, that doesn't get told by the handbills of the time, which depict him, you know, as a kind of grotesque figure hunched over when he really was probably a normal guy in a fuzzy suit. So I really wanted to think about our need to depict each other, and not just the other, but each other in this way, and the way that we can together maybe reimagine that. Mm-hmm. Because I think the danger the hoax provides for me isn't just to the truth, though that is true and vast, but also to the imagination, because often the hoax is saying it must be, it has to be true for it to have you believe it or believe in it. And I think you're seeing these interesting moments right now in American culture of fantasy, of, say, Black Panther or A Wrinkle in Time, which are embracing belief and imagination in this broad way. And, of course, something that's made up can move us. And the hoax kind of denies that as a possibility.
Yeah, it's whether it can compel us and inspire us to good versus confirm our biases and reaffirm our ignorance. And that's the difference between, you know, the good con and the bad con.
Well, I mean, it's tempting to say, like, art I don't like is a hoax, you know. but that's not it. I mean, the hoax sometimes can be entertaining. It is true that there's things that, you know, have kept us or make us laugh. And the way that the hoax kind of approximates a prank sometimes, I do try to talk about and think about the difference. And the prank is supposed to be discovered in, not after so long. But many hoaxes, you know, they're lasting decades and trying to fool us, though at the same time they're always giving us these clues and giving it away. I mean, it's a little like a forgery, a fake painting or something. It has to, both because this is how it works, but also because the artist or forger, I should say, can't help it. It always has some elements that are anachronistic, that are of our time, because the person is in our time trying to imagine what the past is. It's a little like, I don't know, Happy Days or something. It's not really the 50s. It's our memory, the 70s version of the 50s. And so there's this kind of double past that happens in these hoaxes and in these fakes. And one of these paths, I think, has a lot to do with race.
Hmm. In this current era where teams of people are fact-checking President Trump's every tweet and we're finding out more about Russia's meddling with our elections using fake news stories to rile up the voters, is this a turning point? Could it be a turning point?
I hope so. I mean, I think I hated being right about the fact that a lot of the bots you see or the fakery was about the very things I said the hoax has been about for 200 years, which is to say about these deep divisions in our culture. The bots, as it were, the Russian influence didn't seek to be just a neutral force they targeted exactly the same things that the hoax did. Now, if we can talk about those things and maybe have them be lessened, but also learn some lessons from the very things you're mentioning, I do think there's a chance to lessen the hoax. The hoax hasn't always been as high as it is right now, and I think these things do go in cycles. We're in a really bad one now, but I hope that means we could be in a good one sometime soon.
Other than lessons, how do we combat this era of fake news and propaganda?
You know, I work in a library. I have the pleasure of being the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library. And I think libraries are a great place to start. They're always having discussions about these very things. They're thinking about sources. They have sources. And they can help teach us about the reliableness of information and how not all information is equal. And we've kind of lost that idea. There's a kind of notion that there are no more experts, whereas in Barnum's time, anyone could be one. Now there are none. And it sort of, I think that kind of cynicism is really tough to combat. But I think we need to start believing in the word again and start thinking together about what truth means, but also what sources can be, and listening to voices that sometimes aren't just agreeing. I think that's the hard part. There's no really easy way for people to sort of disagree and have it be part of the process. Instead, it's all or nothing. And I think the hoax very much depends on that. It depends on feelings being facts. And I think that's a really dangerous place.
You mentioned earlier that you were surprised by just how many liars and con artists are out there. Once you started digging, it just became a little overwhelming. Talk a little more about that. I mean, how big a problem is this?
Well, like I said, I started 6 years ago, and I really started with a kind of hunch, writing a book about, you know, this phenomenon and trying to understand was it worse. And I came to really see the ways that, you know, in a single week, say in 2008, all these people were exposed, whether it was Naj Dij or the fake L.A. gang member who was really, you know, a white teen from somewhere else. You know, I mean, all these things started happening at the same time. James Frey, I think, was around the same time, who wrote the memoir that Oprah picked and then got revealed to be embellished at best. You know, and all these things started happening around the same time. So I started thinking about, well, why? You know, why are we in this moment? And I think for me, the going back in the history part really actually made me feel a little bit better. It might make it seem like there's this long line and it's endless, but it made me understand the ways that there was a context to understand this, that it wasn't brand new, that we survived that, and, you know, how can we survive this? I think that that research part of it was really fruitful for me, and you know, it yielded a lot of notes and a lot of references, but you can't write a book about fakery and plagiarism and have no notes, though I came to realize there were other people who had done just that. So
I was going to say, how do we know to trust you?
Well, you can read and decide, I guess. But, you know, I think that that's one of the processes we've lost a little bit is what it means to not just understand each other, but understand sources and find out information. And I was just struck by the way that all the stories I tell in the book, they're very much people who are hugely popular. It's not like I found up these really obscure things. These were people who were successful, had bestsellers, or, you know, were in some way and part of our fabric of our talking about ourselves. And then often what's fascinating is how quickly they get repressed or suppressed or just ignored. And that's where I started, where my archival sense really kicked in. And I really loved digging those people up and trying to understand them and read them. And once you do, you're struck by how unbelievable they were in the first place.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite?
It's hard, you know, like to pick a favorite child, even if they're liars. I don't know. You know, I mean, there's some older ones that are fascinating to me. I did write about Rachel Dolezal, and that to me was really an important one for that I resisted for a while. But I ended up persisting on it because I thought it told us something about where we are.
And as I mentioned earlier, and Rachel Dolezal is the one who claimed to be African-American and ended up running a chapter of the NAACP.
Yes, she darkened her skin and changed her hair. And, you know, I think what I came to understand is that sort of surfaced about a week before the Charleston killings, which now seem like so part of this world we're in now, unfortunately. But I think that I tried to understand how they might have been related to each other, which is to say, I think both the Charleston killer, who I take pains not to name, and Dolezal are, in a way, talking to each other or talking about blackness and misunderstanding it in the
really?
Same way.
Talk more about that.
Well, they're misunderstanding it as necessarily tragic. One is so tragic, I want to be like that, and the other so tragic, I want to destroy that. And when confronted with the opposite, in the case of the Charleston killer, being prayed with by these people who he had decided were somehow not people, you know, didn't change his actions. And I think that that resistance to the truth is, I think, at play in both of them, but also the truth that race clouded, you know. And I'm not, when I say that race is a hoax, I'm not saying that racism is a hoax. It's not. But I'm saying that, you know, race can be a construction, a fiction, and in ways fake. But racism can be very real. And in both those instances, I think they're kind of two sides of the same coin.
Looking or moving forward is, can people deal with racism without dealing with the con or the meta narrative that they want to believe in?
Of race?
Yes.
Well, I it's interesting we're saying people. I mean, are we talking about white people or all people? You know, like,
let's say white people. Yeah.
I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of work to be done. And some of it is understanding how we got here. And it can't be a conversation of everything was great and then it wasn't, or, you know, the kind of things you heard even a few years ago that we were in a post-racial society, which seems so untrue now that one wonders why one thought we weren't in one, why we were ever in a post-racial, you know, which I didn't hear a black person say, but I heard a lot in media or and from white sources. So I think that we have to sort of be honest about that. But I also think we have to think about the story of race and the history of race, which is really troubling. And I think that in the U.S., there's a tradition of the complication of race that you even see in the Dolezal and the Charleston question, which is race as ridiculous on the one hand and blacks as ridiculous, and then as these tragic figures to be, you know, destroyed. And I think that we need to change that equation and understand the way that enslaved peoples in the States had a rich culture. We can talk, I think, more effectively sometimes about culture than race, and the way that black culture, which you see being celebrated, say, in Black Panther, is really rich and long, even in its imagination. And, you know, I've written elsewhere about this in different places, but I'm really interested in that black imagination and the way that black style, black jazz, black music, all that is so influential, and we see it every day, but sometimes we take it for granted and you know, discount it as the inventive, continual, and reinventing source that it is. Easily, instead, it becomes something easily borrowable or commodifiable. And it even extends to something like the First Lady of the United States using Michelle Obama's, her predecessor's speech as her own. I mean, that's a really strange moment that now we can't even think about, because there's been a million other strange moments since.
Kevin Young, author of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News, published by Grey Wolf Press here in Minneapolis. Young will be at the Loft Literary Center this coming Monday, March 19th, where he'll be in conversation with author Marlon James. On Wednesday, March 21st, he'll give a public reading at the College of St. Benedict.